The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill cleans up after the elephant in the room. John's shadows cannot be seen, but it's not because he's a vampire. Dave talks passwordless with scores of newbies. Tom gets tenure but can't hold a job. Or rather, no job can hold him. More pitches, more frauds, and more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m., join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
We have a SEAL Technology Corporation on with Nasrat and Mohammed, and I probably mispronounced both of your names. So say each of you say hello and tell us how you prefer me to say your name.
Hey, Fred. It's said as Nasrat, and in the U.S. people call me NASA, like space agency.
So you're really out there, huh?
Yes.
And Mohammed, what's your preference?
Well, I prefer Nasser. Hello to everyone. This is Mohammed Nasser. I'm based in Kabul.
So Nasser and Nasrat, tell us about ASEAL. What do you do?
I'll go first. So ASEAL is a mobile app and a website, and we do two things. Number one is enable anyone to support anyone with humanitarian aid. So that could be anyone in the U.S. helping anyone in Afghanistan.
Let me just be clear. So if I want to send money to North Korea to support Kim Jong, whatever, whoever the current dictator is of North Korea, are you saying I can do that through your app, or is that not allowed?
Yeah, so when I say nothing, there's a asterisk that says all transactions are going through the OFAC system, and it will not go to people who are not approved through the Treasury Department. So anyone who is allowed to have a transfer to.
So sending it to folks in Kabul, you know, that's going to be tricky these days, right? Or is that easy? Nasir, have you given or gotten funding from Afghanistan, and how quick and efficient and easy is that?
But normally it's a bit hard. You need to stand like 8 hours a day in a queue to get like $100 or $200 from a bank or Western Union or MoneyGram. That's a bit hard. And we do it easily through our fintech system, NSU. But overall, the whole banking system in Afghanistan is collapsed after August 2021.
Can you only deal in cash there, or can you do this with debit cards and credit cards through bank accounts? So people, one of the clever ways to do it would be for everybody to have bank accounts in a foreign bank, and you just move money in and out of that bank account. And when you want to pay somebody else in Afghanistan, you just move it into their bank account that's hosted somewhere else. Or do they not allow that?
So as I mentioned, that the banking system is collapsed, so nobody trusts banks a lot nowadays. Only back in the days before 2021, only 10% did have access to banks at that point. But when the collapse happened, most of the people took out their money, and some of the people still has money in the bank, which is stuck, and you need to stand in a queue for 8 hours to get $200 from your own bank account. So that's a bit hard, so you need to give them cash directly.
So now when you say cash, I imagine that you're talking about pieces of paper, right?
Yeah.
And so how good are these pieces of paper? Are they trusted, or do you need eventually to go to gold?
So mostly we are giving cash. So we are using the local currency in Afghanistan, and we give them cash, the cash that we have. So recently, the central bank received 8 billion Afghani, which is recently provided by the foreign countries to them, that they can use it. And because the previous cash that we had in the central bank, it was old and it's still in the market. When you see and look at to the cash situation, the physical cash has a bad situation. You can't really find new notes, bank notes in the local market.
So it's just, it's as risky as it can be, but that's how it is, right?
Yeah.
Do people use other things as currency? Do they use coins or silver or gold or necklaces or, you know?
No, they only use this banknotes, which is issued by the central bank.
People I know recently have turned to crypto. So it's either really, really high-end technology or it's the it's really bad banknotes.
I was going to ask you about the crypto technology next, because, you know, we all know that that's also really, really bad banknotes sometimes. You never know what it's going to be worth tomorrow or whether the exchange is going to just take all your money and use it to buy, you know, jet service to who knows where.
Yeah, it's an extreme situation, and it's crazy to say, but there is around 2 billion people in the world who are totally excluded from the digital economy. So there's no debit cards, Visa, MasterCard reaching to a total of 2 billion people. Yeah, that's where we come in, right? Customized solutions for every country.
So I was going to come to that. Fantastic. Okay, that's really what it's all about, because what you do is bring people into the digital economy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, true.
So tell me how you do this. So you have 2 billion people. Now, I thought that at this point in time, most everybody had a cell phone. I mean, you find people out in the middle of Africa, in the middle of nowhere with a cell phone, and they're charging it via solar. And you find people throughout China with cell phones and India. So what is left? Does everybody have these cell phones, or at least have access to somebody with a cell phone or not?
Yeah, Fred. So I think this is a very common misconception that a lot of people have, is that signal penetration or access to the internet is access to the digital economy. It's not. So 95% of the world has signal. They could be connected to the internet if they want, but you're only part of the digital economy if you can do A, transactions. It means sell stuff, and to get paid for it. Right. So even if you have access to Google.com with a phone, but you can't do anything other than access the internet, you're not part of the digital economy.
So now I'm confused, because I thought that it's very common now to use text messaging to do these sorts of exchanges. And indeed, it's done a lot for changing pricing in rural areas, right? So people can find out what the prices are at the markets and other places just by text messages. And there are a lot of people doing text messages for financial transactions as well, right?
In some parts of Africa, in Kenya, most increasingly, you have mobile money. It's called mobile money, M-Paisa, M-Hawala. That is a very small percentage of people that can use that. And it's reliant on cash out places, right? So if you do send it to somebody in rural area, they might have it on their phone, but they're not able to go to an agent and cash it out. So one, it's a very small amount of people who use mobile payments. It's specifically very much in India and Kenya. That's the two big sort of hubs for it. Other than that, 2 billion people totally in the world are excluded from the digital economy.
Right, so you've said that, but out of the 8 billion people in the world, you've said 95% have access to the internet. So out of 8 billion, that's 400 million that don't have any access at all, right?
Yes, that's not even internet access.
But the rest have at least the potential.
Yes.
So is that what you're doing? You're bringing that potential to the now, you know, 1.6 billion people that you're bringing the ability to do financial transactions to. Is that a good way to say it?
Yes, the ability to sell their products. In our system, it's called buy good, so handmade items, and the ability to send them cash and aid, which is do good in our system.
Got it. When you say send it, if you're, you know, in Kabul, you're getting that by, I guess, by Nasir going to the bank every day and getting $200 out after waiting for 8 hours and then handing out portions of that to people? Is that how that works?
Nasir, you want to answer that? Because you do right?
For now, this is so every 2 weeks I have the right to cash out $200.
Every 2 weeks? Okay, so that's...
Yeah.
All right, so that's not going to be a monetary system very well, but so do you have like, 5,000 people working for you that go in and they each get $200 a week and then you use that? Or how do you manage anything at a high volume with that limitation?
So that's a bit hard right now in the current situation for the current people. That's a very hard for them. So that's why people rarely deposit money in the banks. So even the central bank is trying a lot to promote the banking system and each and everything, but still, due to collapse, a lot of money and customers got stuck.
Yeah, but my question is, how do you solve it?
Yeah, so we did three things, right? So when the government collapsed initially, and this is what sort of is in our core as a company 5 years ago, we look at every country different than the other country. So you have Stripe as a payment processor. They look at the whole world with one eye and say, this is our solution. Whoever fits in can come in. In our case, in Turkey, we have a different fintech system. In Afghanistan, we have a different one. And that's what is our winning point. So initially in Afghanistan, one thing we did was we became part of the UN system, the United Nations. The United Nations would carry cash in planes. Yes, we were part of that. Okay.
So skyjacking is going to return.
Yes, that was the first thing we did in August. So you might have been, watching the news and, people hanging by the plane and, very horrific scenes. The first thing we did was that. We worked with the UN system to put planes, money in the planes and then take them there. That was number one. The second thing we did was...
To comment, it's got to be really hard as somebody who's in that plane working for you in Kabul to resist the temptation to take just a few million, just a couple pockets full. It's an incredible statement if you don't have enormous amounts of theft and leakage from that.
Yes, and I think that's what big insurance companies come into play. They get paid a lot more than what's in the plane, I think. So that's why...
There's a little bit of leakage, right?
Yes, probably. And I think it was insured by our, U.S. government, and they worked with... the Taliban, so that it's secure. Crazy times. Secure this was August.
Taliban. Yeah. Okay. So
yes, this was August, and then from there.
Careful. Yeah. We should be careful not to get Nasir arrested by the things that come out on the show. So if you're uncomfortable with anything, just speak up and say no. Don't say that. Don't put that on the radio. We'll cut it out. No problem. Right.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make its way through. It's very embedded, I think. But anyway, okay, yeah, we got to keep an eye for you, Nasir.
Yeah, I would hate to think that something we had on our show caused you to be put into misery. All right, so look, you do this different for every country. A link to your company is going to be online at thecybershow.co, and they'll be able to click on that, and they'll be able to send money to somebody that they know is needy anywhere in the world, get access to and buy goods from your marketplace, which is now a global marketplace for all sorts of local artisan anything from anywhere, right?
Yeah. So number one is, when we started 5 years ago, we only did handmade things. Well, they're not in the countries that we are.
One of those other unnamed companies that tried to do what we're doing so well.
Yeah, so they only focus on the most developed countries of the world, and we focus on everybody else. They have 16 countries that they support, and we want to support all the other countries that require a harder solution.
All right, so you're staying out of their space. You're not a competitor.
I think if we take over the whole world, the harder parts, then they wouldn't be, they would see at least a bump from us.
Are we going to get better prices, from these harder parts for similar goods?
Of course, because what you have is a lot of resellers. All the pretty much 80% of global handmade production happens in underdeveloped countries. Fred, in the US and the UK, people don't usually do handmade production because they have professional jobs. There is a lot more opportunities. But what people like to do is get these things from underdeveloped countries and then sell them at a higher price because they have access to, which the people in underdeveloped countries don't.
So I actually buy hats from Haberdashery, which is up in Seattle, and they're handmade hats, you know, made out of material. I don't think they make the material. They just get the material from other places, but they're handmade hats. So we do actually still have people in the U.S. that do handmade artisan work, but I'm pretty certain that you could get somebody less expensively to do things around the world. Is that really benefiting those people?
Yes, it is. Even though they get paid less than the people in the U.S., if they can sell it directly to the people in the U.S. and not pay. So let's say, give you an example of Afghanistan. Handmade things in Afghanistan in the provinces are sold to people in Kabul. From Kabul, they are sold to Peshawar, from Peshawar to Karachi, Karachi to Istanbul, Istanbul to Germany, and then to people in California. Everybody gets paid. People in California pay the most money. The artisan gets paid the least money.
Yeah, yeah, I got it. But how do you do shipping? So you have a whole shipping organization. You do all the logistics for getting it from that artisan to me?
Yeah. We do have shipping coming from Afghanistan to the U.S. every 2 weeks. So it's not same-day shipment like Prime, but it's still, you know, yeah, it's really good.
Might take a little bit longer. But it's not just from Afghanistan, right? But that's just an example, right? But you do, what, another 90-some-odd countries, right?
No, right now we only do Afghanistan and Turkey. We hope as we become a public company, we're going to have at least 50, 41 of them are underdeveloped countries.
I see. There you go. And of course, people can invest now, and they can see all about your company by going to the GWiz, and the GWiz will be there on, again, at thecybershow.co for them to watch it. I'm going to say thank you for now.
There's a drive at the deep left field. Look out now. That ball is going. Going out. And they're lefty. Hits it over the left field fence for a home run. And the Pirates win it 10-9 and win the World Series.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Security experts are warning of surging threat actor interest in voice cloning services. Offerings on the dark web are designed to streamline deep fake-based frauds. In one recent example, voice emulation was used to fool an employee into approving a large wire transfer. They thought it was the CEO. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
There's an elephant in the room. Now it's looking at me and you, you, you. Somebody better make a move. So what we gonna do with this elephant?
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years. So in your consulting career, you must have seen unbelievable numbers of different things that were crazy, ridiculous, bizarre. You must have encountered people calling you up because things had gone wrong and they wanted you to save them. Can you just tell us first the generic, you know, how bad is the world out there? And then just some good stories, no names.
One of the things that I found in the consulting practice was that we did a very good job of identifying the requirements. And we did a very good job of formulating a solution and a very poor job of delivering the solution to the enterprise. We didn't budget for it, and therefore we didn't do it. And I had—
You couldn't have sold it if you budgeted for it.
I had two really, really great engagements, one with British Airways and one with Coca-Cola, where I thought
we weren't going to name names, Bill.
I thought that, well, these were so long ago. but I thought that product that I had expressed was really great, and it didn't have the impact on the two organizations that I thought it should have had, because we did a very poor job of delivering it to the users. We didn't even go back and deliver it to all the people that we interviewed to find out the solution. One of the things we learned very early was that the enterprise does not understand its systems. If you look at a particular system and you say, what are the components of this system? It turns out that everybody there has a different view of what's in the stack.
And it's not just that, it's the enterprise as a whole, right? Well, right. I characterize my consulting gigs as seeing the elephant.
And trying to get the enterprise to see the whole elephant instead of the parts of the elephant that it knows about.
Right. Well, these crazy things, right? So you talk to one person and that person says, if this system fails, it's all over. This is the most critical thing ever. And then you talk to somebody else who uses this system and say, no, it fails all the time. I have a copy written down. I can still do it.
Well, I can still work it out. One of the other things that we discovered was that, well, my colleague Harry DeMeo liked to say that the security architecture was derivative of the IT architecture. So the first thing you did was you asked the client, what's your IT architecture?
They probably didn't know.
They gave you a list of all of the materials that they used to build the IT with, but they couldn't tell you what the roles of those materials were. They couldn't tell you what they looked like to the user. They couldn't tell you how they...
It's like all the parts for a house, Bill. So we have, here's all the wood we got for this house. What does the house look like? I don't know. Yeah. Well, we got a lot of wood, but a bunch of nails.
So invariably, when you were asked to do a security architecture, the very first thing you had to do was to identify the IT architecture, which the client couldn't tell you what it looked like. You had to go in and install.
Both of these architectures should notionally reflect the architecture of the enterprise. So the first question I always asked was, tell me how the business works. And the people that aren't at the executive level don't know the answer for the most part. So seeing the elephant, the first thing you have to understand is what the business is supposed to do. Did you have that part of the experience too? Or because you were in the big CPA firm, did you already know that from your prior engagements?
Go back to the brewery. Before I was the punched card operator, I was the messenger in the brewery. That was back in the days when everything was done on paper. And I played the role of the connectivity. So I carried the piece of paper from one role to the next role. I still trade on what I learned as the messenger in the brewery about how businesses work. And
yeah, like working in the mailroom.
Right, exactly. I was in the mailroom. That was my job. And I had I went to the customs house and paid the tax on the beer. And I went to the bank and we had passbooks in those days. And I would take the passbook to the bank.
Oh, yeah.
And the teller and I would reconcile our records to the records of the bank. I went to the Interstate Commerce Commission with all the bills of for the carloads of beer that we shipped. I learned all that stuff from the ground up, and I still trade on it. And my perception is that very few people today really understand how the parts of the enterprise fit together, what the fundamental business functions of the enterprise are.
Yeah, and you can't do the job in cybersecurity if you don't know, what you're supposed to do, right? This, we talk about the duty to protect, right? Nobody tells you what you're supposed to do, and they don't tell you what the infrastructure looks like, and they don't tell you what the company is supposed to accomplish. You can't possibly get to the right answer or anything like it.
Agreed.
Does it sound familiar?
Duty to protect, right?
What do you have? How does it work?
I grew up on the Lone Ranger, right? In World War II comics, happy to be the hero, but tell me what we're fighting. What am I protecting? You know, what is it that I'm responsible for taking care of? And if you can't do that in cybersecurity, I don't know. You want some antivirus firewall or something? You know, no. Who are you? What are you trying to protect? It's such a fundamental insecurity, and it does, not shock, not amaze, you know, but it's one of the things, you know, our ability to actually identify the risk and what we, you know, as individuals, as cybersecurity professionals, even in the industry, you know, what is the duty to protect? We don't say that often enough.
Indeed, we don't.
Indeed, we don't.
So the other thing about it is seeing the elephant. And let's talk about SBOM and DBOM and the whole concept. Right. It's the same thing. They're giving him an inventory. You know, oh, what do you have? Oh, here's an inventory. Nothing connecting that inventory to its functional utility or even what it fits inside of.
Right. You know, what's the context? You know, seven cases of beer and a dog. Okay. That could be in the middle of any story. You know, I can.
Right. So the thing that sort of, you know, tricks it up for me is we're looking at SBOM and DBOM, and you talk about, for example, the two versions of the SBOM. You know, one of them is the static and the other one is what's running now.
Well, a number of versions is, you know, Kate Stewart at RSA just recently, you know, she and I gave a talk, and there's a new CISA SBOM types document out there. She's walking through that, you know, so yeah, source SBOM, build SBOM, your deployed SBOM. You know, how are you comparing these to each other? And to your point, you know, you have to step back and look at the process. Right. And I'm fascinated with the integrators right now. If I'm buying from two big companies, I'm buying from Siemens and Rockwell, pull two out of the air, and I'm building a solution, a water treatment system, you know, how do I enunciate my responsibility to know what's inside the stuff that I bought, configured, selected, sold, and perhaps managed on behalf of my client who's serving drinking water to, you know, 10,000 people?
So I want to get back to what I think is a more interesting issue here. So even with the SBOM or the DBOM and all of the information that comes with it, you don't have the architecture and you don't have the utility. And so, yes, these are valuable things to have as tools in a context of here I am looking at my company or your company and where are all my machines that have this problem that just got identified or you know, where do I find a spare part for this or what happened to the license for that? What's it going to affect if I don't buy this next year? All those are great questions, but the answers in those contexts of just the bill of materials technology comes back with a list of stuff. It doesn't link back to the consequences to the enterprise or what you do with them. So there's another layer in, we'll call it architecture automation, that has to get unpacked here.
Well, that's really like the only thing at the end of the day that interests me in all the supply chain security stuff right now. And seeing to clarify for folks, you know, that SBOM, a software bill of materials, is a document that says, here's what's inside this code. You know, here's the libraries that I use. Here's the compiler I use, the settings or whatnot. Or, you know, it says something about the composition of a piece of software. DBOM, the digital bill of materials, is an attestation ecosystem, open source on GitHub. To your point, Fred, that's the thing about DBOM that interests me is that it's not saying, here's this attestation about, for example, the composition of a piece of software, but putting together the entire thing. You know, why do, you know, what do I want to need to our issue about our topic about duty to protect? You know, I have to, these things I'm responsible for protecting. What information do I need to do my duty to protect those and link that all back as opposed to just saying, you know, again, yet again, oh, another document, another piece of information. What do I do with that? Like, put it in context, and that's what attestation ecosystems are all about. And how do I link all this stuff together in the way that makes sense? Not what the stuff is. Stuff could be anything. Carbon credits. Who knows? You know, SBOMs. It has to mean something in context.
That would be nice.
It will be nice. We have to get there. It's one of these things, right? You know, if we don't get what I see is that level of functionality at some point, and we continue, you know, on all the current trends of, you know, increasing the amount of information and everything else, the complexity, you know, we won't be able to manage any of it. So it has to evolve at some point. I just think that we're close to that point now.
Why is it you think that the world is going to continue to progress?
Ha! Yeah, well, you know, history, you know, it just looks that, well, let me put it this way, because people like it, right? All of the world ending tragedies, you know, that I've been told are about to happen, you know, throughout my entire life, have relied on the fact that we keep doing things the same way. Right. And it turns out, you know, you may not be able to convince everybody of everything, you know, anything, you know, everybody of any one thing, for example, but we all kind of like sunny days and, you know, whatever. Right. You know, so as we approach things that are on aggregate really undesirable, you know, we continue to, you know, evolve ways to avoid that, you know, which in our current era, you know, and this is a long era, we're at, you know, we're talking, you know, past the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the way we deal with that is improving our understanding of more and more complex systems.
I think we may not. I think we might decide that, you know, this is far enough. Or maybe what will happen is the AI will just take over because we're just unwilling to do that level of whatever.
I don't know. As you know, I think that's mostly, you know, a social artifact. I think, you know, the information space that you and I have lived in, you know, highly encourages people of our general demographic to adopt, you know, sort of cynical and pessimistic views, right? You know, everything from Kurt Vonnegut, you know, again, love these authors and everything else. However, we create this narrative that I think is really our way of expressing avoidance behavior, right? You know, let's not do that. But, you know, in creating that narrative, we tend to believe too much of it, right?
But I think the reason that happens is because people just don't want to be that systematic about things.
Well, exactly. We're not. And I'd argue that we are. I think in our normal chaos, you know, based, you know, individual and aggregate social behavior, we have survival characteristics, you know, that map all the way back to the beginning of DNA.
But maybe what this means is that as a species, we are not actually suited to survival at the level of complexity of going planet to planet, and that we're creating now the species, the set of species, the cyber technology with human beings and hopefully dogs, that between us collaboratively, we then have this, you know, codependent group of things that can, you know, mutually survive and thrive and move on from this earthly presence.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I often, you know, talk about, you know, long-term futures, right? Inevitabilities. You know, we look over thousands of millions of years, you know, the minor flaws of human behavior smooth out over time. You know, what's inevitable? And you talk about life in general in this universe, any universe. You know, if thousands and millions and billions and quadrillions of times, you know, planets like ours go through processes like this to develop intelligent life like us, you know, the 100% failure rate of the Fermi, you know, paradox argument, right? You know, that all civilizations always terminate themselves because they're always stupid. That begs more belief, I think, than the opposite. You know, that sometimes, you know, maybe not often, maybe it's frequent, who knows? But life and intelligence can find a way. And you may be in it effectively right. You know, when I look out there, I think, you know, I've gone through the phase of believing things, you know, we're all going to upload and everything else. I tend to think that a million years from now, people will still be people, be, you know, physical creatures that walk around drinking coffee and so forth, because we kind of like doing that, right? You know, and it's just the way it is.
So, I don't know about a million years, right? Because a million years ago is a awful long time in the evolution of Homo sapiens, and it hasn't been around that. But
400,000 years, you know, it's not, and again, there are species that have lived longer, you know, than that, you know, without changing physically a whole lot. It's not a ridiculous period of time. And it removes the vagrancies of...
No, I think if we're going to survive, we're going to end up genetically engineering ourselves to be the next generation of ours.
Sure, but I don't. I honestly don't think the virtual upload, we're all going to live in cyberspace. I don't think that's a thing.
No. Cyber does not understand yet. You know, the artificial cyberspace doesn't yet understand the physicality of people or the physical nature of the world. It doesn't understand anything. I think we understand in the sense of are able to adapt and get along in the physicality of the world. We're not able to do so in the mentality of the world or whatever that is. And that's why we need computers to be able to do that for us.
Right.
Standing in the shadow of our lives to hide our imperfection, doing anything we can to hide.
cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security. We're back with John Tippett, and now we're talking about the stealth ship.
The threat to a surface ship, if you're trying to hide it, of course, is airborne radars. In other words, radars that are looking down at the ocean.
Not surface radars that are looking out.
Yeah, surface radars were a threat up to about 7 miles because that was horizon.
You can see visually at that distance, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, but you might not detect it. You could see it if your eyes were sharp, because you got to remember the sea is not a bathtub. So at any rate, we had, well, there are several major turning points in that. The thing that we were challenged with is that a surface ship, and remember that, well, you wouldn't remember because you didn't know, but the original design of the Sea Shadow was to be a technology demonstrator. It wasn't to go to war or anything like that, but it was 300 tons displacement. And so if you put 300 tons of steel on water, that is, you know, nominally somewhere between 60 and 80 degrees, and the sun comes out, that surface temperature of the Sea Shadow or the tester would probably get up to 100, 110 degrees.
In the oceans in the 40s to 60s, so you'll notice it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it varies, right? It varies.
You also, of course, need an engine, and that's going to make noise.
Well, we had all of the problems that a submarine has because our engines and our propellers were subsurface. And this was a swath ship, if you're familiar with the term. In other words, it wasn't a monohull. So it was a big ship that had legs, and the power and propellers were underneath the water. And so the three observables of a ship, either by radar, visual, or whatever, the biggest observer is what? The wake. If you're ever flying over the ocean and you look down, you'll see a wake long before you ever see a ship. And all you got to do is go to the pointy end, and that's where the ship is. So a heat signature is a major issue, not only because of the hull, but also because of the engines and exhaust and things like that. And then the third observable is noise. And so our technical challenges in order to have this ship unobservable as best we could do.
The difference between seeing it and detecting it, right?
Right.
So your goal was to prevent detection, not make it invisible, right?
Well, yeah, that's impossible. But what we had to do is in the aircraft situation, the threat radar is from the ground or a plane flying. Yeah. Well, in those days, we didn't have satellites that did this. So we didn't,
It was an airplane. Okay.
Yeah. We had a thing called the SR-71. And
it's pretty close to a satellite with really good cameras. Yeah.
So in an airplane, you truly want the object to become invisible or as small as humanly possible so that no one would detect it. No alarm would go off saying you got a B-52 flying over, right?
Yeah.
So now, if we use the same technology, the same band of radar threat, and the same techniques of surface coatings, what the radar would see in ocean would be a black hole going across the ocean.
Yeah, it's readily detectable, yeah. So what you needed to do was project ocean.
Right. So, yeah, that's what we had to do. We had to make the seeable surface of the ship look like water.
So what, did you spray water over the top of it so it was water or what?
No. It was a matter of managing the reflective planes of the ship. And that was the thing that the Soviet, you know, probably 60 to 70% of early work and stuff was all done by Russians. And we had many documents in our library that were either still in Russian or translated Russian documents, research things that we had been able to buy at the supermarket.
So we complain about, you know, our technology stuff being stolen by other countries, but of course we were taking their technology to build our technologies for a long time as well, right?
You think?
So, as usual, when John talks, you have 50 things to discuss.
Right. You know, I had to look this up, you know, but it was 1993 when the Sea Shadow is unveiled to the public. And I remember that. And it's like, oh, that's so cool. Look at this big black catamaran, you know, angular thing. Right. And it's, you know, and looking at where we come from, you know, in maritime systems since then, right. You know, that's kind of the thing a government does, because there wasn't a lot of sense. And I was disappointed to find out it was scrap. They couldn't even sell it. Right. It was an odd duck. Right. And these days you wouldn't build something like that. However, Look at where we are with maritime systems. That was way ahead of the curve.
Right. The things that the government does change the world in many cases in very dramatic ways. But they often seem like they're, you know, almost wasteful or nobody understands why. Although a stealth ship, it's pretty obvious the value. There are so many things he said. One of the things he said, he was talking about the threat is ... right? And this is the concept of the design basis threat, which people don't seem to understand, but it's really fundamental that's the threat that they were trying to address. That's the basis for the design.
Right.
So the design basis threat was what the other guys can actually detect. That's another interesting one, the difference between see or observe and detect. Because you can see all sorts of stuff and you don't know what it is.
Right.
So they weren't worried about them being able to see it as much as being able to detect it. Figure out what it was, you know, characterize it, differentiate it from whatever else they were trying to differentiate it from.
Right. And it, you know, this is 30, 40 years ago, but reflective planes, right? And which, you know, to adaptive wing surfaces, right? You know, there's been investigation of this and so, but still really crude things, you know, hydraulics moving flaps around and, you know, changing the shape of wing. You look forward, you know, the way to obviously make some object stealthy like that, you predict out of the ocean, is to have the surface of the ship reflect things that look like water, right? And then you can do that. You know, we got the technology, you know, in interesting ways. There's been, you know, decades of development behind that. You know, who knows exactly where it is right now, but yeah, that's the way to do that.
Manage the reflective plane, right? So these are the kinds of expressions that once you understand what they're talking about, they are just the perfect words for that. And if you come up to somebody that doesn't know what we're talking about and say, are you managing the reflective plane? They're going to be, what are you talking about?
Right.
There's a plane up there in the air that's being reflected. You're managing, what are you, it's remote control. What are we talking about here?
Well, and that's one of the wonderful things about security. And as you say, the design basis threat, you know, what's the basis threat that you want me to design the security for? And from there, it's all Legos all the way up, right? You know, it's okay. Right. You know, nation state and marine systems, or, you know, you're running a small business, or what is it, you know, and you can build all of it, but it all makes sense. You know, and that's, you know, the endless puzzly thing for, you know, folks like us, right? You know, it's like, it's a fractal issue.
Another wonderful one was he talks about project the ocean, right? And it's such a fundamental to understanding deception, right? That you induce and suppress signals to project what you want projected on the target's view of the world. But that the language is something that has so much clarity when you understand it, and it's such a nice, concise way of describing it. And the other thing is, you know, through coatings, right?
Right.
Okay, well, you know, is that paint or plastic or you know, what is that? How and how do you, like, keep the temperature down? And there's just all sorts of ways you can think of to do it. There's another term like that I love that's used when they talk about electromagnetic issues. and sonic issues, and it's called waveforms. And it turns out, well, of course, waveforms are everything.
Right, everything. And very identifiable, yes.
Yeah, right. So the nature of, you know, the way matter works is waveforms, right? So, but it's such a clear, concise description of what we're dealing with when you're trying to emit waveforms or reduce wave. And the waveform isn't just a sine wave, right? It's the entire, you know, sequence of values as a function of time is that waveform that you can use to, you know, to disrupt or interfere with a piece of electronics, or to break into it, or to observe it, or bounce it off and get the reflections back to hear the sound in the room, like the thing was in Moscow in the embassy. There's just so many things that waveforms covers. And to be an expert in waveforms, it's at a physical level, but it has implications for everything at every level, everywhere. So it's just these wonderful terms of art.
Absolutely. You know, in our analog world.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
We're going to be talking to Dave Bailey for a few weeks about the RSA show that was last week. I've worked with Dave for many years. He's a sales and marketing and cybersecurity. So here we go.
The other thing, you know, the password thing, it's not going to happen, right? People keep saying the password is the problem, right? But to move away from it, you need some, you know, you need a technology either that the human being can readily and easily use as easily as a password, because convenience is also important, right? People say convenience wins out over security, but I guess the reality is that if it's sufficiently inconvenient, that makes it insecure. Insecure in the sense that you can't get utility out of it, because the purpose of the system is the utility you get out of it,
yeah.
Not the fact that it's hard, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the whole point in the commerce space is to make it so transparent and automatic that you can spend money without even really caring or noticing.
Yes.
It's smoothing the transaction, taking all the friction. It's called frictionless transactions, right? And so when you add all these extra security things, you're basically increasing the friction.
Yeah, you're increasing the drag, that's for sure.
Yep. Yeah. So the thing that makes the compelling business case is the situations where you're decreasing the friction and improving protection. So you're getting the best of both worlds. And that's what identity management, you know, did to a large extent 20, 25 years ago. And continues to do in one way or another today. But removing passwords does not. But how about the experience? The experience, you know, on the floor. So you walked around the floor with, you know, for how many hours?
I lost track. Let's see. Well, we got there when it opened and left about almost 5:30 or 6. So I guess it was several, eight, 9 hours at least, right? Pretty much the entire day.
Yeah. And what are all the factors that make it brutal?
Just the vastness of it. You know, there were several hundred vendors there.
More than 500, yeah.
Yeah, definitely overwhelming. A lot of folks eager to engage in conversation. You were constantly shuffling around into different topics. And I have to say, after the first several hours of that, it got to be a bit of a blur. You know, meeting some of these folks, and some of the pitches were pretty similar. Some of them were not, but you had a lot of young sales folks there that had their pitches down, throwing those out. The overall, it was kind of what I was expecting. Was definitely surprised to see a lot of new vendors there, though. There was definitely a lot of new companies that I'd never heard of. In fact, a couple of them I spoke to indicated that, you know, three or four people on the team had only just started a week ago. So clearly there's still quite a lot of hiring going on in the space as well. So
there are opportunities for the service that you're working on, which is to help do marketing and sales, improve marketing and sales for cybersecurity companies.
Yeah. And I spoke to several companies, mentioned that they just recently gotten to Series B and they're still moving along in their wrap up and so on. So clearly, there's still investing being done in this space, still a lot of money being spent in this space. So considering some of the economic headwinds recently, I think that's a good sign for security that that's still occurring.
That certainly is true. The brutality. Tell me about the brutality of doing that.
Well, I think I'm going to pick my pair of shoes a little better next time. You know, forget wearing dress shoes at the next show. But if I was 30 years younger, it would have been a little easier. But we made it through, so I can't complain too much. It was basically a full day, an exciting day, and certainly a lot of
but loud, yeah. Right? Very loud.
It was loud in there, and it was a little warm too. It seems like they got to have the air conditioning cranked up a little better. That's just
loud and hot, and nowhere to sit, right?
And for some reason, sofas were in extremely short supply, unless you went to the Microsoft booth or somewhere. Somebody that had half the floor corralled off for their booth. But for the most part, yeah, there was very little places to sit and chat. That's absolutely true.
Plenty of chocolate. You can pick up a piece of chocolate from any number of vendors.
I actually got a couple of pairs of socks out of it, too. For some reason, there was multiple vendors giving away socks this year. I'm not sure what that was all about.
Yeah, so this was the year of the sock at RSA, right? Not the security operations center sock, the sock that goes on your foot.
Yeah, the sock that goes on your foot, correct, yeah. That's so, right.
I thought that was fascinating. How about, sort of the most interesting tale that was told by a vendor? Did you get any really, fascinating vendors or any clever new ways of saying things or anything like that?
I don't think so. No, most of the pitches seemed like they were pretty well-oiled marketing, jargon. And the sales folks were pretty well-trained on what to say. Didn't get too much of that. There were a couple of the foreign vendors that had some interesting stories about how they started out. A few college kids getting together and starting a company, things like that. I didn't have anything outrageous that hit me in terms of anything that I heard.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers. Tom, how you doing?
Fine. Thank you, Fred.
So, Tom, we've known each other for a long time, but I want to start long before I ever met you with how you first got into whatever it is you got into when you first got into stuff.
Okay, probably one thing I can do.
Let's just start chronologically with, you were born and at some point you probably went to school and you first encountered something related to computers somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I was born in 1942 and went through the typical grade school and high school and then went on to college. And I was fortunate that basically I went on for an Associate of Arts degree at Kendall College in Evanston, Illinois, back in 1964.
And what were you studying?
Well, it was just liberal arts then.
You mean there was no, it was just a liberal arts degree, generic?
Well, yeah, that's what it was. And so from there, I went to the Michigan State University in 1966. And there I studied in the area of police administration and public safety.
So how did you come up? Wait, hang on. Don't rush ahead here. How did you come upon and decide to get into public safety and police administration?
Yeah, well, basically it was just something that I picked up an interest in through high school and my two-year associate's degree. And so going to Michigan State was a real thrill for me. And I got the bachelor's degree, but I wanted more. So I went another year for the at Michigan State and earned the Master of Science degree. And from that point, I decided I want to pursue this whole area of criminology. So I went to the University of California, Berkeley, and I studied in their School of Criminology. And I graduated in 1970. But before I graduated, I took a job at Metropolitan State College in Denver, Colorado. And that was an opportunity for me to start my career in higher education.
When you say you took a job, was that like assistant professor of criminology?
Yeah.
And you say you must have had a PhD dissertation. What was the title?
Oh, I don't recall right now.
Maybe all right. It's been long enough, and the title presumably wasn't like three words, right?
It might have been a study of police resistance to police community relations, something like that.
Okay. So just tell us briefly, what did your study come to conclude?
It concluded that there was a lot of work necessary for the police organization to really become a functioning member of the community, because they were just so out of touch with it. And basically because their job requirements were so tight. But getting back to spring, when I went to this area of, after I got the degree in 1969, I went as an assistant professor, like you said, it was the Department of Law Enforcement and Criminology. And I was there for 2 years. And then I went to the Department of Forensic Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And I was there for a year. And then I went to the University of Arizona. And I was in the University of Arizona in the Department of Public Administration as an associate professor.
So everybody doesn't know this. So when you were an assistant professor, once you become an associate professor, you have tenure, right?
Not always, but sometimes. Sometimes you have to still stay in the thing to earn it. So I was working for it. And then I decided to leave from Arizona. And in 1974, I went as an associate professor at the University of Kentucky in the College of Social Professions. And then I was given tenure.
This is an example of the caliber of folks we know. And, you know, there's nobody better than Tom. But so if you don't obsessively remember the name of your PhD thesis, I take that as a good sign. Right? Because, you know, it's something you did a long time ago. And but he remembers the topic, right? You know, and the it's fascinating that knowing Tom, I didn't know this about him, right? You start with a study of, you know, the ability of police forces to function effectively with the community. It sounds like Tom all day.
Right. I mean, that certainly is what he chose to do with his life. But when you think through it, this is the 1960s, right?
Yep.
You know, Vietnam War, right?
Yep.
So you can imagine there was some interesting questions about this. But what's fascinating to me is he can't really tell you why it is he got into it. He can't. He doesn't say he had a fat passion. He just said, well, you know, I was, you know, walking along and it was interesting.
Right.
So that's what he did for the rest of his life. And of course, we're just getting started with Tom. But so he's, you know, starting to teach and talk about criminal justice, which is, you know, to me, a hot topic. And as we'll see over his career, things get, you know, much more interesting in that vein.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day at 11 a.m. Join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill tries to get a separation. John horses around with $1 million per year of government money. Tom manages to actually hold a job. A wild pitch almost leads to a fire, but it gets quickly put out. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you then.
a good time at bow, a good time at bow, a string beating man and a fiddler for a band, a good time at bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.